It's time for All Things Northwest with Northwest Missouri State University President, Dr. John Jasinski. Each month, Dr. Jasinski will visit with community and educational leaders about exciting developments and collaborations happening throughout our region. Underwriting for All Things Northwest comes from Nottoway County Economic Development and Northwest Missouri Regional Council of Governments. More at facebook.com/NWMORCOG. And now, the 10th president of Northwest Missouri State University, Dr. John Jasinski.
It is indeed a pleasure to join Public Broadcasting's immensely rich and diverse programming designed with you, our listeners, in mind. All Things Northwest has been in the brewing stage for some time. We wanted a show that was devoted to the people, places, events, and stories of our region. We wanted to highlight the great work and the great play, the collaboration, and the developments throughout our region. And on this, the inaugural airing of All Things Northwest, I am pleased to be joined by Maryville City Manager Greg McDaniel and also by Northwest Missouri State University Professor of Art Phil Labor. We hope you'll enjoy All Things Northwest. Greg McDaniel was born and raised in Marshall, Missouri, and attended Northwest Missouri State University. After graduating in 1999, at Northwest, he earned a Bachelor of Arts in Geography with a minor in Geographic Information Systems in 2002. Now, Greg took a variety of positions, went through some educational experiences, but fast forward to 2012, and City Manager Greg McDaniel did take that position here in the city of Maryville back in February of 2012. Greg lives in Maryville with his 5-year-old daughter, who recently began kindergarten at Horace Mann Laboratory School, located right here on the campus of Northwest Missouri State. Greg, welcome to All Things Northwest.
Thank you for having me.
It's indeed a pleasure. And Greg, you and I, we talk quite a bit, and you certainly are involved in the communities throughout the university community and well beyond. But first, let's get this straight. What the heck does a city manager do?
Sure, John. City manager, the city of Maryville operates in a council manager form of government. So our 5 elected council members appoint a mayor and then appoint a city manager to run the day-to-day operations of the city. The city council sets the policies and guides the direction of the city while they enlist the city manager to manage the employees and make sure that their policies and their goals are met.
Okay, so you take care of all of us citizens. We're out there and things happen throughout the community, and you're the one to call. Is that what it really comes down to?
My phone does ring, that's for sure. Okay. No, I do manage 80 full-time employees and 113 part-time. The city operates about a $42 million budget, and we certainly do handle citizen requests and issues on a daily basis, again, while guiding the community in the direction of the council members.
Well, I can speak on behalf of the community that we're thankful for not just what you do on a daily basis, but all of your staff members, because sometimes it's kind of like an offensive lineman in football. You know, you don't get all the praise and all that, and sometimes take some of the grief. But we do appreciate what you do. And, Greg, if you look back at your first 18 months on the job, you know, can you think about key observations that you've had about our community and kind of where we're at and where we're headed?
Absolutely, John. I've had a great 18 months being back. I've appreciated being in the community, being home, where I feel home here in Maryville. And I'm fortunate to walk into a community and a city council that's extremely progressive. I feel like we are moving a lot of things in the right direction with many of our community key players. Some of the observations that we just have a wonderful community, very family-oriented, safe. It's been a great community for myself and my family to come back to. We've got a strong industrial base. So we've got a lot of retail opportunities. We've got some great housing projects going on, and we're really moving in the right direction as a community.
Pretty exciting, all the things that you just mentioned, because as you talk about progressive communities, communities that are broad-based and not just focused on one infrastructure, it's pretty obvious that you're tagged into your home community. And we can describe and really discuss a lot of those projects, but at the top of the list really to talk about is the 4th Street Improvement Project. And for our listeners that maybe have come to Maryville or know Maryville very well, talk about what 4th Street Improvement Project really is and what it could be here in the future.
Sure. The 4th Street Improvement Project is an effort to basically improve the aesthetics and functionality of the 4th Street corridor between downtown and the university. This has become a main gateway to the university and unfortunately has suffered for many years of disinvestment and general decay. So the city council has identified this as a priority and has really worked hard with the university over the past year to identify opportunities to improve that corridor.
And so as we think about a gateway to the university and back to Main Street, what type of features might come about, and what's the timeline? As we can talk about an improvement project, but you know, what will it look like potentially, sure. But also when?
The base improvement project would consist of a 10-foot-wide concrete trail in the north-hand side, a 5-foot concrete trail in the south-hand side, basically to create those safe pedestrian corridors. This would be enhanced with decorative lighting on both sides of the street, as well as a major safety improvement at the Dunn intersection, where it is now a triangle intersection. We would square or tee that off into a more safe avenue for pedestrian and vehicular traffic. A lot of decorative landscaping, the potential for the extension of the Missouri State Arboretum up the corridor into the downtown, public art, a brand new asphalt overlay, and potentially some key university branding elements along the corridor.
Well, listeners, if you could see me now, it'd be with a big beam, because I'll tell you what, it's transformational in nature, and your leadership on the project has been huge, Greg, and we're appreciative of City Council, but I think the whole community, the region, our alumni base will be excited when this project goes into play, which you're talking about next spring, is that right?
We are proposing it to the City Council right now on the budget that we move forward with a $1.4 million base infrastructure project. We have been fortunate over the past year to work with the university and several other key community players to receive approximately $1 million in grants towards the project, so we feel like we have a substantial project to move forward on. Again, we would look forward to move on that in the spring of next year with potentially some waterline work over the winter, but the major piece of the infrastructure beginning next spring.
Well, we're excited about that, Greg. And, you know, as I reflect on that, I also know that both you and our assistant city manager, Ryan Highland, went out east and attended the International Town and Gown Association, ITGA for our listeners, Town and Gown Association. You guys actually presented at the association to national and international audiences. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure, it was a great experience. We were actually the only municipality nationwide, in fact internationally, to be a presenter at the conference. And the attendees really wanted to hear about the partnerships that our local government has formed with Northwest Missouri State University and hear about our 4th Street project's success and how we're working together as a community and university. That is what the ITGA is based on, is solving those problems and those issues and celebrating the successes that can be between universities and the community.
Well, I track the International Town and Gown Association, and there's a lot of exciting things going on. Again, internationally, but also throughout this nation. And it's great to have been already featured. And I know that as our project moves forward, they'll come back on our doorstep and feature us.
They
will.
Thank
you for your leadership on that. Listeners, you're listening to All Things Northwest. I'm your host, John Jasinski. I'm talking today with City Manager of Maryville, Greg McDaniel. And Greg, I'll tell you what, you've been talking already about your approach to city government and those that you lead. One of the things that I'm excited about, Greg, is your approach. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we could address, and you've not gotten too excited and too wrapped around the axle about any of them. You just said, let's go ahead and prioritize, let's address those areas. And, you know, I think this campus town issue that you just talked about is an example. The other things that my team really talks about is how you, as an alumnus of Northwest Missouri State University, have come on board and said, how do I integrate as a city manager into the university life? And an example of that was working with our advanced advertising strategy class here at Northwest Missouri State University, and it really was focused on rebranding Mazingo Lake Park. And can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. That's been one of the key opportunities that we have found is our opportunity to take Mazingo Lake Recreation Park and make it a destination. When we do that, it helps the community, it helps Northwest, it helps everyone involved. When we bring people into town and show them the wonderful feature we have in our back door, it's a 3,000-acre park with a 1,000-acre lake just east of the community. We have really focused in the past year on working with the university in the advanced advertising strategies class to find out what our issues are, rebrand, market, and then promote ourselves not only regionally but nationally. We recently attended the Iowa State Fair and had over 8,000 direct face-to-face conversations with people in the Des Moines area and other areas to promote our lake and our opportunity here in Maryville.
Listeners, if you've not been out to that Mazingo Lake Recreation Park, it's awesome. And you talk about something that's close to home and just a mecca. It's a showpiece. And whether or not you ride a horse, you fish, you go for a few runs, you take your dog out, you just go boating, camping.
Don't forget about our 18-hole championship golf course.
There's so much to list there.
voted as one of the best public golf courses in the United States, and we're fortunate to be the official home of the Bearcats out there for the golf team.
Bearcats love to go out there, although I know that I've deposited a few golf balls along the way across.
So have I.
I can't say in the fairways. They may have been a few outside the fairways there. Well, Greg, those are a few projects. What else on the horizon let's look back a little bit. For what are you most proud beyond those projects, but also looking ahead?
John, you mentioned earlier about my approach into some of the projects we've had and how I haven't gotten worked up on things. And it's really been because of the wonderful Maryville Comprehensive Plan that we have adopted as a community. It's a guide. It's a roadmap for the things that this community has identified as priorities for the next 20 years. Now, as we know, long-term plans quickly change. However, we have, as a city council and as city management, have stuck to that plan and really started targeting our efforts towards meeting the objectives in that plan. Some of the things that I've been most proud of were, one, getting that comprehensive plan through, as well as some of our work behind the scenes to make our organization more transparent and effective in the community. We have recently been awarded our first ever Government Finance Officers Association Distinguished Budget Award. This was a effort, again, with our wonderful finance director, but it's taking our city budget and making it more transparent and easy to read for our citizens.
Well, Denise Town being the budget director and all that goes into that award, it's not just a piece of paper. It's pretty robust, and we're proud of her, that's for sure.
Yes, she does a great job. And we've also been fortunate to finish, on the verge of finishing, a couple major street projects in our community. I know the city council is focused on infrastructure. We've embarked on two major road reconstructions, one on Depot Street, which is east on the eastern side of the community, and then our South Munn project, which is directly adjacent to the Maryville High School. Those projects total approximately $3.5 million, and the Depot project's street ribbon cutting was recently held, so we're glad to be wrapping those two projects up.
Well, Greg, a lot of movement, a lot of positive movement for the city of Maryville. You graduated from Northwest Missouri State University a little over a decade ago. Did you ever see yourself in this role coming back to the city of Maryville?
At the time, not at all, but it is a very fortunate opportunity I've had to bring myself and my daughter back to the community. I spend a lot of hours on campus. My daughter loves walking through the campus as well as attending Horseman for kindergarten here. So we spend a lot of time on the Northwest campus, and I certainly didn't envision that as a student, but it's a fortunate opportunity that I have.
Can you talk about your experience at Northwest Missouri State University?
It was a great experience. I still run into many of the professors that I had.
You're not just saying that because I'm the president.
No, not at all. It was a great experience. It certainly gave me a wide range of skills to move forward. And although I didn't immediately jump into my geography career, I did have the skill set to adapt and eventually get involved in local government and find my way. And I think that's a very important piece that Northwest provides, is that basic skill set to become a successful individual.
Greg, as we begin to wrap up, can you talk about the region's strengths, not just City of Maryville, but Northwest Missouri and well beyond?
Not only the City of Maryville, but the immediate region is a hub for approximately 90,000 people here in Northwest Missouri and Southeast Nebraska, Southwest Iowa. We pull into this area a wide base of people and knowledge and skills. And I believe, you know, our expertise in agriculture and our expertise in industry really brings us to the forefront in a lot of areas. We recently have the Energizer issue that we've had, our unfortunate loss of Energizer. However, it is a significant opportunity moving forward as a community. That Energizer facility pulled employees from a wide range of the area, and we believe that whatever comes in there next will benefit from that workforce. And we look forward to working with Energizer to make that happen.
Final question, Greg. We talk a lot about collaboration, and it's been great to be collaborative with you over your 18 months that you've been back in the city of Maryville. Can you give our listeners a sense of advice about how to be collaborative, and what are those areas that we all should be thinking about as we think about advancing our communities?
we really need to focus on what our roles are in the community. And I know us as a local government has really focused on our role in establishing that collaborative efforts with both Northwest and our other educational partners. We have focused on accepting any opportunity we have to collaborate and know that what we do makes everybody better in the community. We have a wonderful university. We have a wonderful educational system. And when we work together, that everybody benefits.
Well, Greg McDaniel, Maryville City Manager, thanks for taking time today to join us on All Things Northwest. We're excited to have you leading the city of Maryville and look forward to our future collaborations with you. Keep leading and being proactive.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
There are many reasons students attend the college of their choice. Vocal music education major Chloe Ferris had two reasons why she chose Northwest Missouri State. One was vocal music education.
The vocal music education program here is phenomenal. The professors really work hard to make sure you succeed in your major, and I really liked that.
Ferris also wanted to join the Bearcat Steppers.
It was my goal in high school to be on a college dance team, and when I made the Steppers, it was like a dream come true.
Ferris is a freshman from Weston, Missouri.
Support for this program comes from the Northwest Missouri Regional Council of Governments. Sponsor of the Northwest Missouri Career Fair coming up October 23rd from 2 to 7 p.m. at the Maryville Community Center. More information available at nwmorcog.org.
Welcome back to All Things Northwest. I'm your host, John Jasinski. Joining me is Phil Labor. He's an active artist and a professor. He also served Northwest Missouri State University previously as a department chair, but he teaches printmaking and photography in the Department of Fine and Performing Arts here at the University in Maryville, Missouri. Phil holds an MA and an MFA from the University of Iowa School of Art and Art History. He's recognized by the Mortar Board Society for Superior Education of Northwest Students, and he also has received several College of Arts and Sciences Research Awards. Listeners, Phil has exhibited his works in nearly 100 national and international juried and invitational exhibits. He's been visiting artists throughout the world, essentially, and I'll tell you what, Phil Labor has a great perspective on students, on art, and really society. Phil, welcome to All Things Northwest.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
Well, Phil, you came here in 1976, and as you think about the young Phil Labor, your experience, what was it like coming back to Northwest, your mindset around teaching and the like?
Well, you know, when I was an undergraduate student at Northwest, I watched my professors very closely, one specifically, Jim Broderick, who was my printmaking instructor. And it was at that time, I think I even probably made a quote for the yearbook that I was going to go get my MFA and teach college. I thought that was a pretty good goal. I took kind of a curvilinear circuit to get to there, but when I did earn my MA, an opening came up here at Northwest, and it was a one-year term appointment. And I thought, well, you know, I'm going to take that and see where it goes. And fortunately, you know, I was the candidate they selected. And coming back was strange. It was really strange because, you know, all of a sudden these professors, these men and women that I admired so much were now my peers. And, you know, the game was altogether different. And it took some time to adapt to that. But, you know, coming out of an intense graduate program like Iowa has, and it really got you prepared for a lot of both intellectual and peer oriented challenges, and that's where it all started. I was very young.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because I went to Central Michigan University and came out to Northwest Missouri State and taught here for a couple of years, and we were offered a position back at Central Michigan, and we too thought about the same thing, going back and having gone through some great faculty members, great mentors, and then all of a sudden being a peer.
Yeah.
And so we thought, you know what, Northwest is a very special place. Let's stick around and continue teaching. So I'm going to go back for you, back to 1976. You came here as a student. You obviously had some great mentors in front of you. Then you come back in 1976. What was your approach to teaching at the time?
Well, you know, in graduate school, the focus is all on you. I mean, it's all about, you know, your personal experiences and the learning curve. And when I came back to Northwest, you know, I found that the most intriguing challenge that I had was meeting the expectations, the intellectual expectations of my students, you know, because I wasn't very much older than them. And my experiences were broader than theirs, but not by a long mile, you know. And so that's really, I think, what the first challenge that I had to rise to is, you know, all right, you know, these young people are looking to me as a mentor, as I look to people before me as mentors. And, you know, how can I rise to that challenge? And I think in the beginning it was really kind of all about that. I mean, I led them through my knowledge base and my experiences, but it was more a matter of how do I lift them in a manner that other people have lifted me.
Phil, as you're talking about lifting and uplifting students, 1976, talk about your approach to teaching in 1986, 1996, 2006, 2013. How has it evolved, and how has it remained the same in some ways?
Well, life experience intervenes. And so I think my wife, Winnie, and I got married in 1980. And we had children not too long after that. And as you raise a family, as you know, you mature, as you get increased experience in the academic field and in the art world and so on and so forth, you know, you grow and develop as an individual, and all of that influences how you approach material information in the classroom and the expectations you have for your students, the empathy you have for them. I mean, having a family really changes the way you look at, you know, these people that are coming to our campus and have families of their own. And, you know, I think that was the biggest change, is just growing, you know, continuing to grow. I came back, I spent about a two-year stint outside of academia, and I worked at Creighton University as a medical photographer. And I was in a situation that was anything but creative. I mean, it was kind of like anti-creative. And when I left that position, I felt like a caged bird set free, that I could go back into the art world. And coming into teaching was, for me, kind of the best way that I could re-enter that art world, that engage my own ideas, my own creativity, and at the same time, you know, assist others in doing the same.
I'd like to talk a little bit more about your teaching and views on some other teaching methodologies. But before we do, you talk about creativity,
yeah,
and your own creativity. Talk about your artistry and what you're doing today, and some of these exhibitions that you've been blessed to be part of over the span of your career. But boy, as I read the profile, you're talking about not just locally or regionally, nationally and beyond. Talk about your art, your creativity.
It's evolved too. You know, if I go back to the graduate school experience, you know, it's a search. I remember one time we had a visiting artist come to meet with a small group of graduates, and her comment to us was that if you want to make it an art, you've got to find what makes it personal. And she failed to define personal. and so it kind of left us all wondering, well, what in the world does that mean? I have explored that aspect in a lot of different ways through a lot of different media. I'll just list a few. I mean, I'm in photography, drawing, some painting, and most recently printmaking. And what I have, in retrospect, what I've recognized about my own creative expression is that I've had a need to mix things up. You know, to be called a painter or a photographer or a printmaker would be a misnomer, because I tend to draw on my photographs, or I or I incorporate photographs into the computer and then output that into an old-fashioned, you know, 700-year-old printing process. And so being aware of that kind of expressive need has led me, again, on kind of a circuitous pathway that hasn't been the most direct way at entering the art world, if you will. If that's even important. I'm beginning to think less and less that it is. So on the one hand, you know, that's the media, that's the methods that I've chosen. On the other hand, my content of the work has also evolved. And, you know, if I go back to when I was a young student at Northwest, I mean, what was personal for me had to have been my environment. I grew up in Southwest Iowa, in a rural area. The landscape, you know, just, you know, that kind of milieu. And as I've matured, I begin to realize, I begin to follow new interests and different interests, and I begin to realize that I've had a larger worldview, if you will. And so now, I'll just skip across 30 years. Now, my main focus, if I were going to say I have a personal interest or a purpose in making art, it is to explore our larger culture and society and our identity within that.
Phil, you just talked about what might be less important for you now is getting art out into the market. Can you kind of explain that for our listeners?
Well, you know, it's one of the rich, wonderful things about the academic world is it gives you an opportunity to explore those things that aren't necessarily made for marketable, sellable purposes. And you can do research for the sake of doing research. You know, back in the 70s, they talked about doing art for the sake of making art. And yet there is this dominant force in the art world that is the art market, and you probably talk to most young people, they're going to think, well, I want to enter the art world, I want to become famous, I want to be, you know, the next, you know, grandmaster. But, you know, as I've aged, you know, it's still important for me to engage my peers, to get my work out into competitive exhibits, to show nationally, you know, to be part of that art process, but not so much for me to think that, okay, well, I have to depend upon this to make a living, or I have to depend upon this, you know, to determine or define myself.
And those peer-reviewed juries, so to speak, those exhibitions do show your expertise. Also, those are important to your students, I assume, as they think about their craft and moving forward. I know out there across the country, a lot of people are talking about higher education and you should or should not major in this area or that area. And there are jobs in this area and perhaps less jobs in this other major. Talk about an art major and someone who might be going for an MFA. How do they approach not just the field, but also the job market? And how would you teach that?
You don't. I was just having a conversation recently with some of my undergraduate photography students, juniors, seniors who are looking at, you know, flying the nest, leaving, and what are they going to do when they depart, and how are they going to be able to apply what they have learned in their art degree. And within that conversation, you know, we follow a lot of strands, but within that conversation, you know, philosophically, we come right back to the same old story that as an artist, you determine who you are. And as one interested in a career it's either in art or associated with art, you also have to determine who you are and how you fit. You know, art is different from many of our career paths on campus, you know, wherein you may take a very specified core curriculum and, you know, there is a specified job waiting for you when you leave campus. So you go to the you know, the fair, and you meet employers, they're waiting for you. That doesn't happen in art. You know, we think about art in a couple of different ways. One is much more applied. And so, for example, our graphic design students would be more applied. Maybe you could even argue that photography students would be more applied in that they could go out and open a studio or something. But if you are getting a, you know, a degree and your emphasis is in drawing, or if your emphasis is in painting or sculpture, or, you know, some of the steadfast media that, you know, we hold true to, you still have to be resourceful when you leave and find a way to stay true to yourself, you know, to find employment, but do it in such a way that you can connect with those things that you love.
But I assume the process, the significance of the process, and the significance of critical thinking that's being taught within your disciplines are critical to those students moving
forward.
It's
huge. It's absolutely huge. I mean, we do so much problem solving. By the time our students get to the transition between their sophomore and junior year, it, you know, I'll take that conversation back. It's all about them. And, you know, the faculty stop giving them the direct guidance that they did before. They have to start asking their own questions. They need to start finding ways to resolve their own problems. Certainly, we look toward history and contemporary examples to find out how other people have done that. Faculty are there to support. But it's really turning them all around on that personal search, that personal quest where they can begin to define themselves. You know, I tell my students over and over and over, I mean, we are so fortunate to be living at this time in this country wherein we have the opportunity to reach out and define who we are as individuals, you know, to determine our own values, to find our own truths, to examine the world and then reflect upon that and see how we're going to fit into it.
In my travels, Phil, I'm urged to ask you your philosophy on online education, because your answer there about the importance of process and critical thinking and asking those questions and exploring. What about online teaching, online learning in your discipline?
Well, it would be perfectly suitable for certain things. I mean, obviously, art history, I mean, fits right into it. If there were some applied courses where you basically are delivering a knowledge base, and you know, the interaction between the faculty member and the student can be distanced, that would be okay. But I cannot imagine, and maybe it's just because I'm no longer young and I'm old. But I cannot imagine teaching...
You're seasoned, not old.
Okay, thank you, you're gracious. I cannot imagine teaching a figure drawing class or even a beginning drawing class online, because you're teaching people not just how to draw, you're teaching them how to think, you're teaching them how to see. You know, there's this adage, you know, you talk to somebody, you explain something to them, and they say, oh, I see, right? Well, in drawing, you are literally retraining your mind how to see what you usually just take for granted or what you usually just look at. And when you start to see it, it becomes different, just like it becomes different when you say, I understand.
Can someone like me, who has very little artistic acumen, could I go into the classroom and learn from someone like you?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What would that look like?
Well, I would teach you to your strengths, John. You know, I've done that with students, you know, many, many times. You know, this whole idea that there's some perfection, there's some artistic perfection is nonsense. You know, art has, you know, in the 21st century, art has been defined as so many different things. You know, we would just work to understand where your strengths lie. So if you're trying to learn drawing, obviously, there would be some perceptive, you know, some parts of perception that we'd be trying to work on, but it wouldn't be limited to that. I mean, we'd look at how you make marks. You know, what kind of expression do you have when you are literally drawing a piece of charcoal over a piece of paper? Do you do it gracefully? You know, are you clunky?
Yes.
And I've had, I'll give you an example. One of my first students, a young woman from a community not very far from here, came to campus, very, very sheltered. And she ended up earning a BFA in photography, but she took a lot of printmaking and drawing. I remember having her in beginning drawing class. And she had what one of my old colleagues called a wooden eye. You know, she could not see. I mean, the line would go this way and she would draw it that way. And so, you know, we worked with her and worked with her, and she turned out, by the time she graduated, not only to make wonderful images by hand, either in prints or drawings, but in photography. Now, so where does a person like that go? All right, well, I'll tell you what. She ended up being an agent for the FBI. And she was actually flying helicopters around Waco when, you know, that whole incident was taking place in Texas. And she's recently retired from the FBI. And, you know, so it's that kind of self-confidence, critical thinking, problem solving, those sorts of things which are embedded into an artistic search that transfer directly out into the real world, into other kinds of jobs and things you might think about doing.
That is an amazing story. Listeners, you're listening to All Things Northwest. I'm your host, John Jasinski, visiting with Professor of Art at Northwest Missouri State University, Phil Labor. Phil, what an awesome story, because what happens when I go out and travel, people want to hear, student comes in, takes classes, goes through a curriculum, and then goes out, gets done within 4 years if it's a bachelor's degree, and then goes directly to the job market in the job that they went through. And that happens in some cases. Mm-hmm. But the story that you just conveyed is so very important and talks about the rich textures of the university experience. And you know, how do we sell that, and how do we show people the importance of a university? And you even gave an entry point, not just to me, but to our listeners, that if any of us listeners want to take one of Phil Labor's courses or one of his colleagues' courses, we should feel empowered and free to do that, because they'll work with us at whatever strengths we might have in those areas of printmaking or photography. It's beautiful. Phil, what informs your work as an artist? What kinds of works, and who have been influences on you?
There are a lot of artists, more than I could even begin to recite on this, you know, program. Some that, you know, that were inspirational to me when I was a young student. Some that have just kind of become hauntings. You know, they just kind of keep coming out of the museums that I go to visit, and so on. But my influence has been really eclectic. Most recently, I have been very influenced by cultures, art and cultures of the Mediterranean region. And this all started from my having taught survey of art for like 25 years. You know, that boy, when I was told I was going to teach survey of art, that was a shocker. Because when I took my last art history class in graduate school, I thought, I'm done. All right, any art history I'm going to do from here on out is going to be for me. And then second year teaching, oh, by the way, you're going to get to teach survey of art. It turned out to be a love affair. And so much so that I established the first art department and maybe one of the first study abroad programs on campus, wherein we would take groups of students abroad. And so, you know, that grew, that helped me grow as a faculty member. I've got countless students out there that still fondly remember spending 2 months in Italy and thinking how much that's changed their lives as a result. But the Etruscan cultures, the ancient Greeks, you know, just being in some of the sacred places, the sacred locations where, you know, those people established civilizations, going into their tombs, seeing the artwork in their tombs and how that expressed their life and their culture, those things have been huge lately on me. And although my work today tends to be more sociopolitical and an examination of our own, you know, our contemporary culture, I can't help but kind of marry those two, because in my mind, those people went through the exact same mindset and transitions and development that we are here, and probably you could take some of the discussions they might have had at any given point in time and implant it today, and it would fit.
I'll close in a moment and ask you about one of your former colleagues, but you're referencing your work today and really your exhibitions. Can you talk to our listeners about, if they wanted to check out a few of your pieces of artwork, your colleagues, our students, talk about our gallery and the variety of venues throughout the year that someone can come drive into Maryville and partake in the artistic community and all that we have to offer?
Well, I'd encourage him to first start with that fantastic thing that we've got today called the Internet, and just go online. You can find out some things about the department, about our gallery online. Our gallery calendar and schedule is there. Some course materials are there. Introduction to each of the faculty are there. And any of us personally that might have web pages, that's pretty easy. For me, it's just philiplabor.com. And you can basically peruse 25 years of stuff. See the biography and whatnot. So, I mean, that would be the first point of contact. Second would be to come to campus, obviously. And when we have prospective students come, that's really the selling point for us, is when we get them in the building and we can start showing them, you know, the exotic places we have, like the Pit and the undergraduate student studios that are down there that are a real luxury. Very few, you know, schools, they'll cater to the graduate students, but the undergraduate students just don't have any places carved out in the community. And when they see the kind of, you know, community that we have within the faculty and the students and the environment, it's a real seller. And at that point, I think you can start talking to the parents and say, okay, you got to have a little faith here. You know, that you're sending your child here to get an education, not necessarily to create, you know, to have a vocation. I think that's what it's really all about. You know, it's finding an avocation, finding a way to do what you love and make a living at it too.
When you talk about finding something that you love and make a living, that's a great segue to the late Russ Smalljohn. Russ, Professor Emeritus at Northwest Missouri State University, passed away this past July 29th. I know his life celebration was very special for his wife, Suzanne, his kids, family members, colleagues, students, and even our community members. Russ impacted so many so greatly. In researching for this program, I pulled a quote from the exhibit and the booklet that was put together from a book of alumni art. The quote was from you, and it said this: "From the scrutiny of my youth, Russ seemed to be an unusually quiet, enigmatic, and gifted artist. He later became my informal mentor as I learned the subtleties of university teaching and artistic dialogue." Phil, can you reflect on Russ's life and what legacy he left for all of us Bearcats?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it is something that was movingly powerful to the generations of students that he encountered as a teacher, and I believe that, you know, that is going to sustain and continue. I mean, it's a snowballing effect. As I grew with Russ, and because we spent many years together on the faculty and at picnics and with our children and everything else, as I grew with him, you know, I learned that impression I had as a student, as a young student, wasn't entirely correct. One, he wasn't quiet, very outspoken, softly outspoken. It was voracious reader. He's probably the best read faculty member in the department. Always go to him, you know, to talk about what he's been reading and what would he recommend. And he believed in old-fashioned things like writing and journaling and reading and finding ways to input that into their artwork. You know, Russ was just a jewel. He kept people alive.
What kind of art would best describe Russ?
Yeah, good. You know, you get to know people in different ways at different times. And I got to say that when I finally knew Russ was in, I think it was 1998 when I was in London in the Victorian Albert Museum. And Russ would have been back here on campus teaching. I walked into this grand gallery space, and it was filled with the work of Bernard Leach, a very famous English potter. And I went, God, Russ has been here. And, you know, he had an association with a Japanese potter, Hamada. And they worked in St. Ives for many, many decades. And I know that Bernard Leach was a big influence on Russ's work. So, you know, you might want to say, okay, Rush was a traditional potter. Sort of. Russ was a traditional potter with a Nebraskan sense of humor and a curiosity that wouldn't abide and an intensity that you know, just went far beyond the imaginative, you know, in an imaginative sense, the things that the traditional potter would have. I mean, he expressed that clearly, and he was unafraid of it, which was just great, because, you know, to know somebody like that helps you have the courage to go on and do the things you really feel you need to do.
Well, it's pretty obvious that you've had that courage to do the things that you've needed to do, Phil. Phil Labor, art professor at Northwest Missouri State University, thanks for taking time to join us on All Things Northwest. Your art is an inspiration, and your teaching and insights are reflective of the high quality of faculty here at Northwest Missouri State University. Thanks, Phil, for what you do. Thanks for teaching us. And thanks for sharing your thoughts on the late Russ Smalljohn.
Well, thank you for giving me that opportunity, John.
Many students who graduate from Northwest are very successful. Kansas City's Mix 93.3 on-air personality and KCWE-TV host Steve Serrano is one of them. Serrano credits the hands-on experience he received at Northwest.
I was really able to get started and do what I really wanted to do in the broadcasting field right off the bat, right when I was a freshman.
You can listen to Serrano weeknights on Kansas City's Mix 93.3.
Underwriting support for All Things Northwest is provided by Nottoway County Economic Development, promoting the community, supporting business development, and growing opportunity for Northwest Missouri. The NCED Business Support Team is at your service. More at nottoway.biz.
Friends, I'd like to close this month's All Things Northwest by paying tribute to Russ Smalljohn. When I came to Northwest in 1986 as a faculty member, Russ was a senior faculty member, and he treated me no differently than any other, with respect, with passion about the subjects in which he engaged, and telling me in a direct manner as he saw things. He was himself. He was comfortable with that, and I am forever grateful to have come to know Russ and his colleagues. Russ's brother, Alan, quoted E.E. Cummings to memorialize his brother, and I quote, "Almost nobody can learn to think or believe or know, but no human being can be taught to feel. Why? Because whenever you think or you believe or you know, you are a lot of other people, but the moment you feel, you're nobody but yourself. To be nobody but yourself in a world which is doing its best night and day to make you everybody else means to fight the hardest battle which any human being can fight and never stop fighting." That was from E.E. Cummings, and Alan's brother said Russ was nobody but himself and an artist besides. To our public radio listeners, you may or may not have known Russ, but I know you can appreciate his art, his teaching, his life, and being himself. I must say I rather enjoyed the bagpipe and the songs and remembrances during Russ's memorial, as they were all quite fitting and they were eloquent. But certainly closing with Norman Greenbaum's Spirit in the Sky was inspirational, to say the least. Yet, Russ was indeed his own man, and appropriately, the beloved icon Garrison Keillor topped Spirit in the Sky by reflecting on the relationship that Russ and Garrison had through our own public radio. Let's take a listen to Mr. Keillor's tribute to Russ as we close this October 2013 edition of All Things Northwest.
Radio is a magical medium that allows a person to form close personal friendships with people you're unlikely to meet. And one of those was Russell Smalljohn of Maryville, Missouri, who was a potter and a woodworker, an art teacher at Northwest Missouri State, who worked in his shop. I wrote in mine, two guys working solo whose experiences were, I'm sure, similar, even though people don't applaud for ceramics so much. But we both had the discouragement that comes with the business, I'm sure, and the perfectionism that can be so hard to bear, and the passion for the medium, and persistence, the thing that gets you through. And it's an honor to think that my little campfire was seen by him over on his hill, and I'm glad at last to see his. This is a song by my friend Iris Dement. When my morning comes around, no one else will be there, so I won't have to worry about what I'm supposed to say. And I alone will know that I climbed that great big mountain, and that's all that will matter when my morning comes around. When my morning comes around, I will look back on this valley, at these sidewalks and alleys where I lingered for so long, and this place where I now live, it will burn to ash and cinder, like some ghost I won't remember when my morning comes around. When my morning comes around, from a new cup I'll be drinking, and for once I won't be thinking that there's something wrong with me. And I'll wake up and find that my faults have been forgiven, and that's when I'll start living, when my morning comes around.
Support for All Things Northwest comes from Nottoway County Economic Development and Northwest Missouri Regional Council of Governments. More on Facebook at facebook.com/NWMORCOG. Theme music for the program was composed by Northwest professor Dr. William Richardson. The music was recorded by vocal music education major Jordan Andrews, piano, music major Daniel Bates, bass, audio and production major Mark Ludwig, drums, and Dr. William Richardson, trumpet. The program is written and produced by multimedia journalism major Ben Noley. Join us again next month for All Things Northwest.